Asira, not necessarily. Those are the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine, and we're going to be talking about the anthrax vaccine, about some exciting things that have come up as far as Gulf War illness. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. You kind of caught me at a different location because we're working on a big program for Africa and the AIDS problem down there.
Oh, well, I appreciate so much you taking the time to be with me, and I know you're in the middle of all sorts of things, but when we last talked, you were going to perhaps tell us a little bit about the fact that the Canadian government now is willing to go along with your approach to the Gulf War illness, which our government, of course, still denies exists.
Well, I think they still can deny it, but too many other countries are now, I think, coming to the reality that there is something there that needs to be taken care of. And I must say that the British government, the Canadian government, to a lesser degree, the Australian government, have come to a different conclusion from our own Pentagon, in that they realize that the chemical exposures, the biological exposures that occurred during the Gulf War, exacerbated by the vaccines and the other treatments and exposures that they received, all contributed to real illnesses, Gulf War illnesses, plural, multiple illnesses, because of deployment to the Gulf War. There have also been a couple of epidemiological studies that have come out, I think since I last had a major period of time on your show, that indicate that these illnesses are associated with the vaccines. And I think the study that I was most impressed by was a study coming out of Kansas. And it was done by the State Department of Epidemiology and the Department of Health, so really credible people. And they studied all the Kansas veterans from the Gulf War, and they found out that if you were deployed to the Gulf War and you received your multiple vaccines, you were at a much higher risk for coming down with Gulf War illness than if you received the vaccines and weren't deployed. And the lowest group in terms of incidence were the people who didn't receive the vaccines and weren't deployed. So there's this intermediate group that was never deployed but received these multiple vaccines that have an incidence rate of illness between the undeployed, non-vaccinated, and the deployed vaccinated group. So that, to me, really smacks that the vaccines were contributing to the problem in a major way.
Do we have any idea why it was? Was it because of the squalene that seemed to be in there that suggested an experimental vaccine? Was it because of the anthrax vaccine? Was it because of mycoplasma infection? Do we know what it was about the vaccines that created the problem?
Well, I think all of those things probably created a problem, and unfortunately, the shot records were classified, so we can't go back and carefully study this problem. We don't know exactly who got what in terms of experimental vaccines. That would give us a big clue as to where the problems might be. And of course, the anthrax vaccine, I think, is a major culprit in this whole thing, because we're seeing people coming down with Gulf War illness or Gulf War-like illnesses that didn't have anything to do with the Gulf War. They just received the anthrax vaccine.
All right, fine. And, of course, if the administration, if the government were to accept the responsibility, you're talking over 200,000 people they already have acknowledged are ill, and aren't there a lot more that are ill that they just haven't acknowledged yet?
Well, that's true. I mean, if you start counting the family members, and we just
hold that thought right there.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Dr. Garth Nicholson of the Institute of Molecular Medicine, and we were, of course, talking about the Gulf War illness, and not only are many of the veterans ill, but many of their spouses are ill. So there is something here very real, and it's not one illness at all. It is a group of illnesses that have many, many causes. But the interesting thing is that Dr. Nicholson has pointed out that in Canada, they want to take care of their veterans, and they're accepting their illness. This is taking place to a lesser extent, or at least it's taking place in England, perhaps to a lesser extent in Australia. And yet, of course, the people at the Pentagon, the people in our government, keep denying that this is a real issue, or that there is something here that is really disabling these people. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. I think there are elements, there are people within the government that want to do something about this and are very sincere about it, but there are others that are not, unfortunately, because they have something to hide.
Well, now, do you think that the depleted uranium plays a part in this?
I think it does, but I think it plays a very minor part from our studies for two reasons. Number one, most of the people that were sick were nowhere near areas where depleted uranium munitions were used. That's the first thing. There were many people that were in Saudi or in areas on ships, for example, in the Gulf and so on, that were nowhere near areas where depleted uranium was being used. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we know that there are certain soldiers that were hit in armored vehicles with friendly fire using depleted uranium. And again, in studying the illnesses that those soldiers have, again, they're not really the same as the other illnesses. So we can't attribute exposure to depleted uranium to account for all the illnesses that we've seen from the Gulf War.
But at least there was some sort of an illness that the people were in the tanks that were hit by our own fire. In other words, there was something that happened to them physically if they survived?
Yes. As far as I know, but again, the types of problems that they have are not exactly the same as the problems that some of the other veterans have had. So I don't know. It's hard to say what role DU had to play in this conflict. It was perhaps a contributing factor, but I don't think it's a major factor.
All right, fine. And of course, the great tragedy is we have so many different facets of this whole illness, and it gets sort of confusing. And when the government says, well, there's no single factor responsible for the condition, I think they're absolutely right. It's really multiple factors, isn't it?
Oh, yes, and we've said that all along. But, I mean, that's kind of a, you know, a screen that they put up. There's no single...
Hold that thought. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go right ahead. You were saying that that's a screen that they put up.
Yeah, it's a smoke screen that they put up to kind of a way to backhandedly deny that there's a major problem. Yes, we thought all along that there were multiple causes, and we thought all along that there were multiple illnesses. There was no Gulf War syndrome. There was no syndrome associated just with the Gulf War. So all of that was kind of a smoke screen. You could deny that there was no syndrome, but that didn't mean that we didn't have all these casualties, we didn't have all the sickness and illness. You can deny that there's a single cause, and we all agree with that, but that doesn't mean that people aren't sick. They may be sick because of multiple causes, but that doesn't get at the main reason why they're sick. We need to find out the causes, the underlying causes of all these individuals, and it's complicated, but I do think that we found certain subsets of illness, one associated with chronic infections, like Brucella and mycoplasma, others associated perhaps with chemical exposures and so on. And these are treated differently. They're not treated the same. So you're not going to have the same kinds of treatments and the same success treating everybody with some generic approach. It's just not going to work.
Well, now, you mentioned, of course, that there's a subset that has mycoplasma and Brucella infections. Are these the ones then that are transmitted to the wives?
Yes, these are the ones that have a transmittable disease because you cannot transmit chemical exposure. So where we have wives and children becoming sick, and there were a considerable number of these after the Gulf War that became sick, and one government study that done by the U.S. Senate group, they found in surveying 1,200 families that 77% of the spouses and 65% of the children were exhibiting similar signs and symptoms to the veteran that they weren't exhibiting before the war, before the veterans came back from the war. So we think there's something there. In the end, I don't think the percentages or the numbers are going to be quite that high, but I think they're going to be considerable. They're probably half the spouses, and that may correspond to about a 40 to 45% rate of infection that we found in the Gulf War veterans. And so we'd expect that those families where somebody has an infection and it's gone untreated, it's not acknowledged, they have the chance of spreading that infection to their spouses and to their children and actually to their co-workers as well.
Now, that was the figure, that 40% figure was what was in the Rockefeller Committee report. I'm sure you're well acquainted with that. Well, tell us a little bit about the anthrax vaccine, because I know you've been very, very concerned about the anthrax vaccine and, of course, its disastrous effects on some people.
Well, we've been, you know, written a few articles on this that have appeared mostly in environmental medicine journals and elsewhere, really detailing why this vaccine should not be used. And there are a number of reasons, which I'm not going to bother your listeners with. Some of them are quite technical, but basically they boil down to the following problem. The anthrax vaccine, the way it was designed, is a vaccine that is stored for an indefinite period at refrigerator temperatures. Well, you know, if you put anything, I don't care how it starts out in the beginning, in a refrigerator for a few years and then take it out, the chances of it being contaminated are pretty good. And in fact, they found a very high rate of bacterial contamination in these vaccine lots when they tested them. They also found that there were a significant number that had lost their potency and so on. As a matter of fact, when they first started checking on this and the FDA did some tests on the anthrax vaccine, they found that 4 out of 5 of the vaccine lots failed. You know, so these weren't sterling products to begin with. And I have a lot of questions about how they not only generated the products and how they stored them, but also how they tested them and so on and so forth. But without getting into a lot of complicated things, I think it's safe to say that these are not excellent vaccines. These are not even good vaccines. I think they're bad vaccines, and I don't think they should be used for our military personnel or particularly for civilians.
Well, isn't it possible to make a good vaccine either from a genetic fragment of it or some other means? I understand they just take the anthrax and they boil it up or something, and this is sort of an extract of the anthrax virus or spore or something.
It is an extract of the anthrax bacterium,
right.
And as such, it is not a very pure vaccine. There's potential contaminants in it. But there are some other major problems than that, and that's just one of the problems. We'll go into the details, but there are a number of problems with the vaccine, and it's not a new vaccine, and the major problem that they have with developing a new vaccine is how to test it, and so that is a major problem that they have to overcome, but they need a different approach, and using the recombinant DNA technology, it's possible now to generate a recombinant vaccine that has much less chances of being contaminated, and they're probably doing this right now. They're not going to tell us exactly what they're doing, but this is, I'm sure, one of the routes that they're taking. The other problem with the vaccine is that it's not very effective. It was never designed against inhalation anthrax, and of course that's what somebody would meet in the battlefield. The anthrax that it was designed to counter was cutaneous anthrax. So this is where anthrax gets in a cut that you have in your skin and so on. And that actually produces a slightly different clinical condition than the inhalation anthrax, and it's not nearly as life-threatening as the inhalation anthrax. So these are differences which are important, because if you base all your technology and all your testing and your clinical trials on a cutaneous model and then market it and sell it as a counter to inhalation anthrax, you're selling a pig in a poke, and I think that's what's been done here.
Well, I share your concern, and certainly the government said that there were very, very few adverse reactions, but, you know, reading some of the things that I've read by people who've looked into this, there is a significant number of problems, you know, with reactions to the vaccine, hasn't there been?
Oh, yes, in the way that they tried to stifle those, the reports, in a way, is they actually, you couldn't report an adverse reaction to the anthrax vaccine unless it was you were hospitalized within 48 hours after receiving the vaccine. Well, number one, getting hospitalization for a vaccination is you really have to be near dead. The second thing is that most of these events that we were talking about, for example, minor contamination and so on, don't show up within 48 hours. They show up much later. So that the 48-hour cutoff period is arbitrary, and I think it's a wrong cutoff period. The fact that you know, it's not an adverse reaction unless you're actually in the hospital, unless you require hospitalization, I think that's pretty severe. So a lot of these things were, you looked such a high cutoff that very few adverse events were ever reported. And of course, the way they were reported, you know, was voluntary, and so you just can't have that kind of surveillance and expect to pick up any adverse reactions.
And, of course, I don't think the Army looked very kindly on any of the servicemen there that reported that they were ill after the vaccine. I think a lot of them were probably rather loath to report it, weren't they?
Well, that's it. As I said, unless you were actually allowed to report to a hospital and you had to be on your deathbed, it was not an adverse reaction. That's all there is to it, and that's how it was reported. So we've talked to many people that went through this and had terrible problems and sicknesses, even within the 48-hour period, but were denied hospitalization because they didn't want to report it as an adverse event.
Well, I think when politics enters into medicine, and we get into some very, very real problems, and I think this is what's happened with the anthrax vaccine. Is there anything else we should cover there, or should we perhaps talk a little bit about some of the work you're doing with AIDS in Africa?
Okay, well, we can just end it by saying that you're exactly right. It is a political problem. It's a political problem because the government 50 years ago bought into this idea that they could counter biologic weapons using vaccines. And in principle, I think that's probably okay, but you have to be practical about these sorts of things. And in comparing it to the French approach, they appear to have been much more successful during the Gulf War. Instead of using vaccine technology, they used the prophylactic antibiotics. They had very few casualties to Gulf War illness from the Gulf War, and yet all the nations that were involved that used the vaccines, like the U.S. forces, all had terrible problems. Again, 15 to 18% of their deployed forces were ill after the conflict with these Gulf War illnesses. So, you just need to learn. History teaches you, and you need to go back and learn that and not repeat history, bad history, over and over again. And unfortunately, repeating bad history over and over again, we've heard that there have been, at least the last report I heard, that there were over 6,000 of our forces deployed to Iraq, which had to be sent home because of various illnesses, and some of these associated with the vaccine. So we're making the same mistake all over again. It may not be as severe because they learned a bit about the first Gulf War, but they're still making basically the same mistake again.
Well, you know, you mentioned, of course, that Canada is going ahead and accepting a recommendations on treatment for Gulf War. How are you approaching this? Are you approaching this from trying to stimulate the immune system or what?
Well, basically, if they have infections, you have to treat the infections. You have to boost the immune system because many of these patients have compromised immune systems. If they have chemical exposures, you have to slowly deplete the chemicals from the system and so on. So basically, you depending upon the types of exposures, you have different treatment strategies, as you should, for each patient. So it has to be individualized. That's the first thing. And the second thing is you can't just accept that this is all in their mind, that this is some post-traumatic stress disorder problem or something like this. This is a grave error that we made after the first Gulf War when they tried to cover up that there was any illness. And they said, well, if there is any illness, it's got to be due to stress. Now, stress can exacerbate problems. If there's an underlying problem, yes, stress can make it worse. But I don't think stress causes the illness. As a matter of fact, even the psychiatrists that have studied the problem have shown in their own published studies that post-traumatic stress disorder is not the same as the Gulf War illnesses when they examine those patients. So stress may have, you know, a minor role to play in these things, but it's not the major player.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to just take a quick break here, and then when we get back, I'd like to talk a little bit about AIDS, because AIDS is certainly something of major concern to me, and what's happening in Africa today is certainly one of the great tragedies of modern times. In fact, I wrote a book one time. It was called AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. Based upon the fact that doctors know how to stop epidemics, you saw what we did with SARS recently, they stopped that epidemic in its tracks, and AIDS, of course, is spreading throughout Africa and Asia and China and the world. Seemingly unchecked. We'll be back in just a moment here with Dr. Garth Nicholson.
Most people would laugh at the idea that there is or has been a secret society. I wanted to tell you about a tape we have. It's a talk I gave before the Concerned Women of America some years ago, and it basically goes back into the background behind the secret society, which was formed in England and eventually came to America and came to be known as the Council on Foreign Relations. It goes into the background of Cecil Rhodes. And how does that secret society that he created impact on you today? If you read the works of Professor K. Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, you will understand that Professor Quigley is probably one of the leading experts today on history, but also a man who had the courage to speak out. You need to get the four-tape set, The Secret Government, to understand what Professor Quigley taught Bill Clinton. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In the 1970s, there was a group of Italian immigrants in the small town of Rosetto, Pennsylvania, who drew worldwide attention for their unusual cardiovascular health, despite their pasta diets. I recently uncovered the fact that their unusual health was attributed to the precious red wine which they imported from Italy. Today we know this as the French paradox, the fact that the French exhibit greater cardiovascular health despite their fatty diet because of the red wine they drink. Wouldn't it be great to enjoy the health benefits of red wine without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives? Well, now you can with Longevinex, the world's first stabilized red wine molecules, preserved in an airtight capsule just like in a sealed bottle of red wine, equivalent to 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex for healthy aging without the calories and alcohol. 866-405-4000.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I want to tell you about the Big Berkey and the Berkey Light water filters. The Big Berkey is made out of stainless steel, holds about 2.5 gallons up there at the top. You pour the water in the top, it goes through the ceramic filters that are packed with activated carbon, comes out the bottom, tastes better. You've taken out most of the chlorine, most of the herbicides and pesticides and all the other sides and most of the bacteria and other things. So you can actually take pole or pond or river water and run it through here, and it'll be safe to drink, because this is what missionaries have used throughout the world for so many years, over 150 years. Now, the Big Berkey is $239.95, and of course, it does a great job. It's available in every state in the United States except for California and the state of Iowa. However, you can get a Berkey Light, and a Berkey Light is made of Lexan, so it's transparent. They have the black Berkey filters, and they're, we call them water purifiers. They do a wonderful job of filtering out the pesticides and herbicides and chlorine and MTBE, and they will actually take out literally all the chlorine and all the MTBE and all the bacteria. There's nothing quite like them. Black Berkey filters have to be, however, changed every 2 years, maybe a little longer if you're only a couple of people using it. If you're using it a great deal, they have to be changed every couple of years. Now, both the Big Berkey and the Berkey Light will take post filters that'll take out the fluorine, but that's a separate, and you should get rid of the fluoride from your drinking water. So if you need that, you get the post filters, and they have to be changed every 6 months. But there's nothing quite like either the Big Berkey or the Berkey Light. The Berkey Light is $199.95. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the Big Berkey or the Berkey Light. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And before I forget, Dr. Nicholson, do you want to get out the information on the Institute of Molecular Medicine, how people can get in touch with you if they have these chronic infections that seem to defy explanation by modern medical standards?
Well, if your listeners want information on autoimmune illnesses, on chronic illnesses of various types, they can either contact us or go to our website, which is better, which is www.immed.org. It's like immediate.org. And there they can find, there must be 30 to 50 publications, actual medical publications, reports, and so on, that they can download right from their computer and get the information they need about some of these issues that we've been discussing. For example, there are 6 publications in there, and I mean publications in peer-reviewed medical journals, on the anthrax vaccine and the issues surrounding the anthrax vaccine, and they can download those from the site. There's a lot of information on various chronic illnesses, because we don't only work on Gulf War illnesses. We work on chronic fatiguing illnesses like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. We work on autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and a number of other chronic immune conditions, bowel immune conditions, for example, like Crohn's disease, inflammatory bowel disease. we work on other types of infections like HIV, and we're going to, I think, talk about that. We also work on solutions to these problems and how to boost your immune system, how to eliminate fatigue. We have some new products that we've run clinical trials on that are kind of interesting, and actually we're starting a new clinical trial on asthma. And so if there are any listeners out there that are interested in asthma and would like to take part in a all-natural product clinical trial, they can go on our website and on the web page, click on clinical trials and access the website for the asthma clinical trial that we're conducting. So these are some of the things that we do and make available to the public. We're a nonprofit organization, so there's no cost to any of this.
And that's immed.org, and of course there's a telephone number if you need to call. Well, doctor, tell me about your approach to HIV, because this is certainly a terrible scourge. It's killed so many people, both here and throughout the world.
Well, we've been working mainly in the third world on this problem, and as you know, these are areas in the world like Africa and Asia where they can't afford the types of very expensive drugs that are available here in the United States. So the programs that we're working on can't have those expensive drugs as a part of the program because they just can't afford them. They would just they're just non-existent in these countries because of their cost. So we have to come up with very low-cost solutions. And so we're often using the natural products in the countries, the natural medicines and so on, to help boost the immune system, to help fight the viral and other infections, bacterial infections that are really the cause of AIDS. The virus just sets you up for it. But once you're set up, then you're susceptible to a variety of different viral, fungal, and bacterial infections, and that's really what kills you with AIDS. So we're trying to work on their general health, trying to change their diets around to a diet that is more resistant to these types of infections, trying to provide them with locally grown nutraceutical products that are not costly, they're very cost-effective, to help them overcome these infections.
Would you feel that the mycoplasm plays a part in this, as has been suggested?
Oh, yes, very much a part in that. We've conducted our own studies, and others have as well, showing that this is one of the prominent infections in the HIV-positive population. And these infections, and again, that's just one type of infection, there are many other types of infections that these patients have, will eventually cause the morbidity, illness, and death that these patients will experience. And in the third world, of course, this is a much bigger problem than we could ever imagine, because again, they have very little in the way of medicines, and their approach to the problem has just been dismal, and I think the records indicate that. The death rates and the infection rates are high, and again, it's not just a medical problem, it's also a social problem. We need prevention programs, we need educational programs, and so on. And we're trying to put those together into a program for Africa. That's why I'm not at my normal place today, working with a group that's interested in doing something about the problems in Africa.
Well, one of the great tragedies of modern times. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. I'm with Dr. Garth Nicholson of the Institute of Molecular Medicine. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, as we'll explore perhaps what they're doing here in the way of trying to increase the immunity and immune response and general health of the people of Africa, where it's estimated that this disease has already killed about 30 million people there, and certainly 500,000 here in the United States.
Set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination, a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president, and then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this four tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Let me just mention the JFK assassination tapes is a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty. He was immortalized in the film JFK by Oliver Stone as the colonel who sat on the bench with Kevin Costner, who played the part of Jim Garrison, and said, continue your effort to find out about who killed Kennedy. I'm sure there was a conspiracy because I was the Pentagon liaison to the Central Intelligence Agency. So you'll have a two-hour interview with Fletcher Prouty, who has passed on. But this is part of history. And then there's an interview with Dr. Crenshaw, who was a resident physician in the emergency room at Parkland Hospital on the day that President Kennedy was brought in. And, of course, that they brought in the Governor Connally of Texas, and even when Lee Harvey Oswald was brought in. He was there. He witnessed this whole thing. Eventually he wrote a book about it. And 20 years later he wrote a book, of course. He originally was threatened and told not to do anything. When he wrote a book 20 years later, he was attacked viciously in the American Medical Association Journal, the JAMA. And so he sued them. And they said, well, we know we're right, but we don't want to go to trial. We'll just give them $200 to make the suit go away. Well, of course, they weren't right. They were simply doing what was politically correct. You couldn't let the American people know Dr. Crenshaw saw was entirely different wounds than, of course, the American people were allowed to know. Obviously, President Kennedy was shot not from behind, as we were told by somebody in the Texas book dispensary. He was shot from the front, and was the back of his head was blown off by the bullet that entered his right temple. So part of history, the four tape set, the JFK assassination tapes, and of course we have the JFK update with an interview with Lyndon Johnson's mistress. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine. And he, of course, edits, I don't know how many medical journals he's got. How many peer-reviewed journals articles do you have at the present time, doctor?
Oh, I would close to 600 now.
Close to 600. When we first met, it was about 400. So certainly Dr. Nicholson is well-known and well-respected throughout the nation and within the scientific community. Well, you're talking about Africa and, of course, the part that mycoplasm plays. Does mycoplasm play a significant part in most cases of HIV, along with HIV infection, as well? Is it sort of a combination of the two?
Well, we think it goes along with the HIV virus. There are other diseases like Lyme disease where you see the same situation, that there are multiple infections that seem to go together. And so we know that mycoplasm is one of the infections that is very commonly found in HIV-positive patients. And part of the reason is that it's an infection that's out there. It's been out there for a while, and it's a very common infection. And once you get it, it's very, very difficult to get rid of. And so that's the problem, and it is a major source of morbidity in a variety of chronic illnesses. So when people are chronically ill, no matter how they got chronically ill, they get one of these infections, and it's a major problem, and it could be a major problem for the rest of their lives.
All right, fine. And, of course, this is really an increasing problem even in America today of these chronic infections, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And, of course, the reason why we're trying to do something in Africa that's a little bit different is that they just do not have the resources to buy the Western medicines like we have here in the United States. It would just break the countries and nothing flat. So we have to come up with another solution, and so we've come up with kind of an African solution using natural African products and so on that the people can grow themselves, and setting up small and expensive sort of day clinics where they can come in and get their nutraceuticals and learn something about diet, because diet's a very important part of any chronic illness, and unless HIV-positive patients adjust their diets, they're never going to recover. So we recognize these problems, and so we try and deal with them in a local way so that we can take out some of the politics, we can take out some of the expensive medicine that's required, give them fairly inexpensive things to help them out. And so far, it's working quite well in some of the rural clinics that we've set up. And now there's a foundation that's very interested in expanding this to a number of other states. We started small in Zimbabwe with about six clinics, and now that's going to be expanded many, many fold all over the southern area of Africa. So where we were starting in just one country, in a few years we'll be in 12 countries. So this is a major effort that an international foundation is undertaking to try and do something about the problem in Africa.
Well, I really appreciate that. Have you had fairly good results in Zimbabwe with the clinics that you have operating?
We have. We've had very good results. Most of the people that come in are often on their deathbed, and so it requires some extensive work to get them out, but most of them walk back out again, and they walk out with some education. They walk out with some natural products that they can afford to buy and use, and we also work with their families as well. We have the whole family come with them. The central part of these little clinics turns out to be a kitchen. It's very important to try and teach these people the proper way to cook food and the proper food to eat, particularly if somebody's chronically ill. So we try and give them that kind of training as well as give them some prevention, some education, and so on while they're there. So these are little clinics that, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was down there a few months ago, and in each of these clinics there's a large courtyard, and there must be 50 families out there that sleep there because they can't afford to go anywhere else. So they come in, they walk in. I don't know how many miles they have to walk to find their way to our little clinics, and then they just stay overnight in the courtyard, and they get their meals while they're there, and they get their education, and they get their treatments, and so on. So as far as we know, it's the only African solution to this problem that I think will have any impact at all.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's fascinating. In fact, I know my friend Dr. Lorraine Day has told me that she is knows people treated here with diet who've actually recovered. Seems incredible. You know, as a traditionally trained doctor, you know, we have to have a pill or something of the sort. But of course, I'm sure you're absolutely right that nutrition plays such an important part in these diseases. We've got a Radkin calling from Vermont. Is that the correct name? Is it Radkin?
That's all there is, Dr. Stan.
All right,
and
fine.
It took me a while. This is the first time call that I've had the honor to talk with you, and I understand so much why your voice trembles, and I sense you breaking into tears so many times over the tragedy that is transpiring from these evil people. And I have learned so much. I'm 58, but I feel like a homeschooler, learning from your show and others.
Well, God bless you for saying
that.
Well,
no, God bless you and the others who are fighting to expose these Luciferians. With Dr. Nicholson, are you familiar with Professor Don Scott's research on mycoplasms?
Yes.
Corroborate his findings.
Don Scott is actually an adjunct member of our faculty.
Oh.
Even though he lives in Sudbury, Ontario, in Canada.
Yes.
Which is not too far from you, I understand. But we've known Don for a long time.
Oh, yes, he's a sweet, dear man. I've heard him many times. Quickly, Elizabeth Baumgarten. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but I remember in my notes somewhere that she was targeting a Von Harp having to do with the anthrax mailings. And whether or not she is okay.
I couldn't answer that question.
Okay. Listen, the anthrax mailings, was that the inhalation type or the cell type? I mean, the epidermal type?
Well, again, the anthrax itself, it just depends on how it gains entry into the body, whether you call it cutaneous anthrax or inhalation anthrax. Inhalation anthrax. If it gets in through a cut in your skin, it's cutaneous anthrax.
But I think the mailings were pulmonary anthrax. That's why it was so devastating.
The mailings, actually, yes. The mailings were the Ames strain of anthrax, which is a government strain that's been around for a long time. You know, we just have never received the genetic details on this to know where it came from, and I wonder why they haven't released that information, because it would give us a good indication of exactly where this came from. And I have a suspicion that the reason they're holding back that information is it probably came from a government laboratory.
Well, I have that same concern. In fact, I am extremely concerned, although this is a little off the subject, but we have from a number of sources the fact that on the very evening of September 11th, the Vice President, Dick Cheney, and his entire White House staff started on Cipro. Now, why would they have done that? You wouldn't do that unless you thought that you were going to be an anthrax attack, and if you thought or suspected there would be one, you have a moral obligation to warn others. They took it themselves. They didn't warn anybody else, and I wondered why they were so suspicious on September 11th, 2001. But that's simply another subject. Well, anyway, of course, I think the work that you're doing in Africa is going to be so vitally important because the AIDS epidemic down there is impacting on really on the economy. It really threatens so many of the upper-class people. In Botswana, which is a very advanced African country, why they say up to almost 40% of the adult population is infected. They're going to wipe out a whole generation of the productive people there.
Oh, you see that when you're down in Africa in certain areas. I know best. I know a little bit of Botswana, but best Zimbabwe and parts of South Africa. You know, there's a generation that seems to be missing in some of these areas. You go in, and where are all the teenagers? They seem to be gone. You know, and they've died essentially, and their parents have died. And so it's just absolutely devastating in some of these communities. And yes, many of these countries have 40% infection rates. So you know that they're just going to be decimated. And it's hard to prevent that, but you have to do something about it. And you have to do something about it. You can't sit around and argue, what are we going to do type of thing. You need to roll up your sleeves and do something. Well, for the last 10 years or so, we've been down there, and we've been supporting personally even clinics in places like Zimbabwe where they have a major problem. In the rural areas, for example, the townships and so on, they have a major problem in terms of education and prevention as well as in terms of the disease and so on. So we're trying to do more. We're getting some international foundations to help, and I think that's going to be the only thing that will save these countries.
Well, of course, you know, they're talking about, you know, giving the people these medicines like we give them here, AZT and all the other heart medications, but the people are still eventually going to die with that. Do you think you can reverse this, at least with some people, with proper nutrition and these other substances you're talking about?
Well, we don't know if we can, you know, reverse the situation. We can certainly take people that are incapable, for example, of holding down a job and get them well enough where they can actually work and support their families again, which is significant down there. And again, by changing the diet, by educating them and so on, prevent the rest of their families from coming down with this devastating disease process. So it's a major problem. It's a major problem anywhere where you have it. But again, the added problem down there, the added difficulty in Africa is the fact that they just do not have the resources, the financial resources, to use a Western solution for the problem. And that's why we've been working so hard to try and get them to go to a more African solution to the problem. It's the only thing I think that's going to work in Africa.
Well, of course, when I lived in South Africa, why, the major staple of the black population was mealie meal and meat. Now, what sort of diet are you going to get them onto?
Well, that's a colonial diet, and that's exactly the diet that we get them off of as soon as possible. And, of course, you pinpointed the problem, dietary problem down there. That kind of diet will not help them with the AIDS problem. If anything, it will contribute to the problem. So we try and get them back to a more natural African diet, really try and increase the vegetables tremendously in their diet, and increase the greens and the various vegetables, and basically reteach them how to cook an African, and like the Africans always cooked. And so a major focus is an educational effort. In fact, in our clinics, a major part of the clinic is the kitchen, and whole families come in and learn how to cook a variety of different meals using all vegetables and so on, in a way that which is delicious. And I even think the food is great the way it's done. And it gets them away from these colonial diets that are killing them, along with the infections and so on that they face.
Well, you know, I've learned more about nutrition since I got onto talk radio than I ever did as a physician, and really the rest of my life. And, you know, working with people who've been on these diets and seen some miraculous things happen, and doctors have researched the background of this. And it's so obvious, you know, that the scientific studies are all out out there that you certainly have a far less chance of getting cancer if you're eating a proper vegetable fruit sort of diet. I find myself increasingly going to the fruits and natural things now, trying to get away from the diet which seems to be so deleterious to the people of our own country.
Well, that's, again, you focused on a major problem, and that's hard enough to overcome in this country, let alone, you know, in another country. But we're making headway, and I think that's the important thing. And the only reason we're making headway is we have the results to back it up. And otherwise, we wouldn't last a day down there. And so the people see the advantages, the economic advantages of the way we're approaching the problem and so on. And basically, it's just a daunting problem down there, and you can't, we could throw all the money in the world at it, it wouldn't solve the problem. So we had to go back and figure out a more natural solution to the problem, rather than this artificial Western medicine approach.
Well, it's, you know, right now, of course, in Zimbabwe is in terrible, terrible straits, apparently. You know, there's just no money. The inflation's 1,000% or so all year. And of course, there's no food for so many of the people. How are you getting the normal nutritional food for the people?
Well, again, it is a major problem down there. In the rural areas, it's actually a little bit easier because they do have the capacity to grow things there. In the townships, the major black areas around the cities that were part of the apartheid system, that's a major, major problem there, because getting the right food into those areas and getting the people to change their ways, it's a little more difficult. So I would say that we're actually doing better in the more rural environments than we are in the townships, but eventually the townships, I feel, will come around and see the wisdom into this type of approach. They can't afford the Western medicine, so they can't use that as an option. They have to go to an African solution to the problem.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's exciting, and I'm really so glad that you have something to offer these people. And mainly, I'm glad that you can get some help from some of the foundations so that you can carry out your work there, because so much of the money is going into the same old things that have failed. You know, certainly as I look at what's happened in South Africa, and I look at the incidence of disease, as we mentioned earlier, Botswana, 40% of the adult population infected. Why, this is either the greatest public health failure of all time or a genocidal success, and it really doesn't matter which one it is. What we're doing is wrong, and it's got to be countered. And so at least you're over there with an alternative approach to the problem.
Well, we hope to really expand that approach, and again, I hope in a few years we'll be in, instead of just in two or three countries, we'll be in 11 or 12 countries, and we'll hopefully have a larger and larger presence as our success grows. But our little clinics, supported on a shoestring, are doing very well, actually, and now the government's come to realize that this may be the only salvation for them in the rural areas, and so they're starting to get behind us, and I really have to, my African colleagues are the ones driving this. We really only play a part-time role in that whole process. They have to live it 24 hours a day.
Well, if any of our listeners out there would like to help, how could they perhaps contribute to what you're doing? Because I know that you really are self-funded, or funded by people who believe in what you're doing, as I do. How can people help you?
Well, we can certainly use any help that anyone could give us. We have programs for veterans. We have programs for chronic illnesses. We have programs for AIDS in Africa. We have all these needy programs, and we certainly don't have enough people helping us out with this. And they can go to our website, again, which is www.immed.org. It's the Institute for Molecular Medicine, and we're located in Huntington Beach, California.
All right, fine. And if they'd like to contribute, how would they go about doing that?
Just in any way possible. They could contribute funds, money, gifts, anything.
Oh, right.
Believe me, we have plenty of uses for it. When you just think of the African program alone or the veterans program alone, these are huge programs that we've initiated, and they're going to require a lot of resources.
And I think in many respects, well, you've done more than anyone else as far as identifying the problem and then coming up with solutions. Well, Dr. Nicholson, thank you so much for your help in this matter and for taking your time to be with us this afternoon, especially when you're in the middle of something else that's so important. Is there a telephone number that people can call, or should they just go to the website?
It's best if they go to the website, because we often get flooded with telephone calls, and then people end up talking to a recording, and irritates the heck out of them. So if they write us or go to the website and send an email or something like that, it's often easier. I was up at 2 a.m. this morning answering emails to people, so you know, it's something I can do, whereas I don't dare try and call and return a call at 2 a.m.
I know, and I can't decide whether the email is a curse or a blessing, but anyway, we can't get by without it. God bless you. Thanks so very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I hope you've enjoyed our special program with Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine.
Set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination, a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president, and then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this four-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I just want to mention that we carry Phonopoly. And Phonopoly is a wonderful game. It's played like Monopoly. It's loads of fun, but it's designed to teach you or your children or your grandchildren how to read and pronounce words and spell phonetically. Phonics is the major reason or the major means by which children are taught to read or adults are taught to read. And that's why they don't use it in our schools, because there's been an organized effort to dumb down our people, and they've done a pretty good job of it. You talk to a lot of people today, and they really are incapable of reading or thinking effectively. Well, let me just suggest that if you'd like to get a Phonopoly set, most of these programs, $800. This program is $139.95. It's 5 board games, 2 bonus games, and we throw in a couple of books to explain to you how they've dumbed down the American people. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And of course, they certainly haven't taught our people about the America's Christian heritage. It's one of the most carefully kept secrets in America, but you must understand this country was founded by Christians on Christian principles, using the Bible as the basis of our law, and the Ten Commandments as the basis of our law. You need to get back to the fundamentals. You need to get back to the Institute of the Constitution. Call them at 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068, and request a kit for the Institute of the Constitution, or go to their website at iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. Programs are being set up all across America. The more we have, the sooner the American people are going to understand our heritage and join us in helping to take America back once again. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you in the listening audience to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, 5 hours on the Internet. You can hear our programs. You go to RadioLiberty.com, and, of course, you can hear our early morning program on the American Freedom Network, and then, of course, America, that's AmericanNewsNet.com. You can hear our program here for 2 hours on GCNLive.com. You can hear our second hour on RadioLiberty.com, and then our evening program on RadioLiberty.com. You can hear our program 4 hours a day on shortwave, and if you're listening now, we'll be back in 3 more hours with a fascinating program this evening at 5.745 megahertz. But your job is to tell other people about our Internet programs. Your job is to tell other people about our shortwave programs and encourage them to begin listening to our programs. And that's how we're building a listening audience across America. And people are becoming aware of what's really going on. So we hope that many of you will make it a point, first of all, to go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can pull down our newsletters going back to the mid-1990s, copy them, check the facts, and certainly then circulate the newsletters, tell other people about our programs there. There are lots of archives, go back about 6 weeks, so you can spend all of your time listening to the 5 hours live and then going to the archives. But we really want you, of course, once you begin to understand what's going on, to help us reach others. Now, we have a number of wonderful tape sets. We have a tape set on the secret government. We have a tape set on secret societies. We have a tape set on Skull and Bones. We have a tape set on the Bohemian Grove, and all of these are occult organizations, and they all tie into my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, because there really are secret organizations out there that work within the inner core of the CFR, which is a front organization, although most members don't know that, that goes back to the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created in 1891. And, of course, we've read the diary of a man who was there. William Stead's diary tells about how they organized the secret society, and it's all laid out in the documentation in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and you can get that by calling 1-800-544-8927. You should get the book, or better still, get the book, the video, and the audio tape for $29.95, and then copy the video and copy the audio tape and get others to listen to it, because it's up to you to reach others, to help them to understand. We're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. And then, of course, we hope that you'll get our video on Iraq, the untold story, explaining that all the wars of the last century were contrived, and the war we're fighting over in Iraq today has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. And we'll give you the references to the writings of the people in the Project for the New American Century, including Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who in the year 2000, before there ever was an attack, were saying our interest has been having an American presence in Iraq for decades, and we have to be there. Our interest transcends the regime of Saddam Hussein. In other words, it doesn't matter about Saddam Hussein. We want to have our troops stationed in the Middle East. And if you get behind this, it all has to do with the New World Order, the New World Religion, which is the common denominator behind everything going on. Help us to get the information out on the church growth movement. Get our video, Diapracts in the Church, our 4-tape set on the church growth movement. Understand that we are in World War III already. You need to get the video Megiddo, and you can get any of these on both video or a DVD. Get our video on Iraq, the Untold Story, our video on the Brotherhood of Darkness, and then pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. Pray for revival. Because if America doesn't turn back to God, can you give any reason why God should ever bless this country again? And lastly, we ask you, of course, to remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-544-8927, and we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.